Today in Studio 360,
the early outcasts like me were late to sex and careers.
The performer Patton Oswalt always had a hunch that he wasn't required to fit in.
If we did find a vocation, it usually involved drawing or writing or something creative, work that's done in the home and usually alone.
When he was a kid, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright David Lindsay Abaire had a different strategy for being accepted.
You know, I was the funny kid, so I was never picked on for being the poor kid, but I also didn't advertise where I came from, and I tried to get myself a pair of khakis and some Izod shirt so that I fit in.
And I'll speak with Bruce Ferguson, a new dean at the American University in Cairo.
In my opinion, it's not so much a political revolution as it is a cultural revolution.
I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more is just ahead in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Support for Studio 360 is provided by PBS, celebrating 25 years of Les Mis and its classic songs like I Dreamed a Dream, Do You Hear the People Sing, and Master of the House, with the Les Miserables 25th Anniversary Concert, Sunday at 7, 6 Central on PBS. And by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. As the rebellions and maybe revolutions continue to simmer and boil all over the Middle East and North Africa, we've been wondering about the cultural precursors and the cultural impacts of what's going on. Bruce Ferguson has been a major figure in the world of the arts for many years, and just last fall, he became dean of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences at the American University in Cairo. And so, a few months into his new job, he found himself in Tahrir Square, in the middle of the revolution.
You know, it was like a roller coaster. There were moments in which things shifted so quickly emotionally that it was hard to, you know, stay on top of them. There was a rumor that Mubarak was going to step down, and this woman was screaming it over in a corner, and people started to rush to her like she was the Lady of Lourdes. They just had to almost touch her to hear it and believe it. So there's this kind of moment of unbelievable panic and mob sort of mentality, and it was like when you're in grade 10 and you put the magnet under the iron filings and everything follows the magnet, you know. So she became the magnet for a moment, and these thousands of people charged forward to listen to this rumor. And then the other thing was I took one photograph, and it was of a soldier on a tank in front of the Egyptian Museum. And when I saw it later, I realized he had the exact pose of Michelangelo's David, and he was just standing in that exact pose in front of the museum, but he had a machine gun, of course, in his hand. So there's something about those kind of things that, you know, stick with you. There's days in which it felt like you were at Woodstock.
Right. Have you seen yet the sense in which the revolutionary moment is driving the art that people either at the university or in Cairo generally are doing?
Well, actually, it's an interesting question, Kurt. I think it's almost the opposite. In my opinion, it's not so much a political revolution as it is a cultural revolution, and that the films and the artworks that were done before, the plays that were done before, the books that were written before, in a way are part of the creation of an environment and a platform that allowed for this to happen. So, you know, there were films about the garbage workers in Egypt. There were films about, you know, police corruption. And these are within popular culture. I mean, narrative films or documentary films and novels. And there was a work of art by a woman named Amel Kenaway, which was a performance she'd done where she'd hired people to crawl across the streets. And in a way, the performance had held up traffic and so on. And then it caused a sort of a public discussion of whether she was denigrating Egyptians by doing this or whether she was showing their sort of humiliation by doing this and so on. There was a huge outpouring of expression in the square itself, from cartoons and caricatures to, you know, people holding signs. I mean, one of the signs I liked the best in Arabic was an old man holding a sign up that said, you know, please go, Mr. Mubarak, my arm is getting tired, you know, things like
yes.
that. Just this kind of constant sarcasm and witticisms and so on.
That's so interesting to me that you really see and can trace this cultural softening up in preparation of at least the fraction of Egyptians who pay attention to the culture and the popular culture. It's also interesting, given the what I understand to be the cultural space that was indeed permitted these last 10 or 20 years under the Mubarak regime, actually readied the people to rise up.
Yeah, and again, I think there's definitely some of that preparation was done. But then there's other factors, you know, Obama coming and giving that speech that he gave and what happened in Tunisia. It's not one thing, but the cultural aspect of it, I think, is probably
right.
more important than people have yet given it credit for, I would agree.
I know you've talked about the art scene that's emerged in places like Beirut and Istanbul being very mm-hmm. exciting. Is there a way to talk about that art, or is it as eclectic as the rest of the global art scene today?
I think it's as eclectic, and in fact, I would say, you know, in Beirut there's sort of, you know, a counter kind of position. I mean, I was at dinner one night when artists and people in the arts field in Beirut were complaining bitterly that the global curatorial world, in a sense, came to Beirut only to find war art, you know, and if you didn't do war art, you were sort of excluded. So it was just another form of, you know, of privileging of one thing over another and that sort of thing. So one can imagine, you know, curators flocking to Egypt now to find, you know, revolutionary art and, you
yes.
know, et cetera. I mean,
I have a narrative. Please fill in the blanks.
Yeah, exactly. or give me the image for it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Do your colleagues, your Egyptian colleagues and friends that you've made have, as they think about what's going to take place next month, next year, have any worries about a possible Islamist backlash that would shrink the cultural space available to them?
It's really not on the front burner. I would say, you know, the worry is more, I think, about the military, and, you know, there are not many liberal military groups in the world. So everybody now uses the word democracy for everything. If you get a bad cup of coffee, people will say, that's not the way they do it in a democratic society. I want to, you know, so it's like it's being used.
Little do they know.
Every cause. Yeah, little
yeah.
do they know, exactly. But, you know, so it's being used now to qualify everything and to think about everything. It'll have some awkward moments at the coffee bar. But other than that,
yeah.
I think it's, in general, a good thing, Kurt.
Bruce Ferguson, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Bruce Ferguson is the Dean of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences at the American University in Cairo. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. For most of the 20th century, painters and sculptors who had no training or art world connections were called folk artists, and their work hardly ever appeared in museums, and almost nobody knew their names. But then in the 1980s, they started being discovered by the art world, which renamed them outsider artists. That's when Thornton Dial's reputation and career took off. When he was 60 years old. He's now 82, and the Indianapolis Museum of Art has just opened a major retrospective of his work. His pieces are sometimes abstract, sometimes figurative, almost always incredibly vivid and colorful, and sometimes subtly political. To my eye, Thornton Dial is one of the most interesting artists of the last half century, whatever pigeonhole you stick him in. He lives in Alabama, where he's part of the large African-American majority in his hometown of Bessemer. We sent Gigi Duban there to find out more.
Bessemer is an old industrial town. In its heyday, it was a center for manufacturing iron, coke, and steel. Thornton Dial earned a living here as a factory worker. He built the same boxcars that rumble past the building where he still keeps his studio. When I arrive at Dial Metal Patterns, I'm greeted by the artist's sons, Richard and Dan.
Hi.
It's 4 p.m. and they've just brewed a pot of coffee.
We drink it all day, every day.
Huge machinery fills the space, including conveyor belts and a pair of forklifts. The Dials used to make patio furniture here until the high cost of steel put them out of business. They still use the leftovers for art, Richard Dial tells me.
The iron and stuff, basically from the scrap and the stuff that left off from when we was, you know, building patio furniture here, and some of it, you know, I purchased from just the local steel mills and stuff.
His dad, Thornton Dial, comes here to work, but doesn't give interviews these days. He's 82 and slow to get around. His son says in the last year, his father has survived a stroke, pneumonia, and heart failure. But that hasn't stopped his art making.
If he breathed, he's going to try to create something. And that's been the way that he's been all of my life.
Since he was a kid in the 60s, Richard Dial remembers his father making yard art, everything from huge metal sculptures to decorative fishing lures. It was only when a collector from Atlanta discovered him, the wider art world started to take notice. By then, Thornton Dial was 60 years old.
Being honest with you, I think this thing probably have went way further than he had imagined in his mind that it would go. And I would say the same thing about the family. You know, I never thought that he would get this type of recognition from, you know, the art.
So what does Dial's art look like? He uses all kinds of mixed media and found materials, like chicken wire, branches, toys, and buries them under layers of paint, creating patterns that look ordered and jumbled all at the same time. Several are collages with oddly paired elements, like a pair of rubber boots set among metal grates and brambles. Before you know it, you're drawn in. But giving the art a chance to sink in is often the hardest part. Richard Dial says that even now, many of his dad's pieces have to grow on him.
You know, once you get a feeling for it and it starts doing something to you.
I'm starting to know what he means. Dial is looking at a relief called Monster in a Cotton Field, which his father finished a few months ago.
And these pieces, wall pieces, are some of Thornton Dial's most recent works.
Joanne Cubs is here, too. She's the curator of the Indianapolis exhibit. On this canvas, there's a baby doll hovering near the middle of the piece.
A baby that is sort of embedded in a cotton field.
And a tiny clawed robot, the Monster, in the upper left-hand corner.
That's right. It's actually a found, I don't know what you would call it. It's a found toy. It looks like some sort of transformer.
There's a mixture of fibers, branches, all white, except the edges of the piece are yellowed, as if it's smoldering. Kind of creepy. In the warehouse office, I met Dial's best friend, Richard Lindsay, who's 85. He was hunched over a glowing gas heater. I asked him what he thought of the art.
I wouldn't pay 5 cents when I first started. When I first started coming down that, I saw all this work. I said, what is all this junk going down here, you know?
Lindsay says over their 20-year friendship, he started to see Dial's work differently.
He taught me about art. He told me what to look for in art and how to read art.
So it's made in Alabama, uses local found materials, and it's all put together by a self-taught artist. Does that make it folk art? Joanne Cubs doesn't think so.
I think that all those labels that are assigned to the work of artists like Thornton Dial, like folk, self-taught, and outsider, have nothing to do with the way that an artist looks at him or herself. They have to do with the fantasies of those who have the power in our culture to decide what is art and how art should be labeled and defined.
The more research I did on Dial, the more I realized he's virtually unknown in his hometown. I asked James Nelson about it. He's the visual arts critic for the Birmingham News. He says that compared to Atlanta or Chicago, Birmingham is just not an art-loving town.
If we had promoted art like football, made it the thing to do, the thing to go to, the thing to argue about, the thing to drink beer with, it would become important in people's lives. At this point, a very small minority of Birmingham goes regularly to small galleries around town. They just can't support all the artists that are working.
I wondered if the locals in Bessemer knew the famous artist in town. So I stopped in at Bob Sykes' barbecue. It's just 5 minutes down the road from Dial's studio.
You've never heard of Thornton Dial?
Never heard of him. I've lived here all my life, and I've never heard of the man.
Meanwhile, Richard Dial has faith that the audience for his father's work will keep growing and growing.
Some artists is just recognized on a global scale, you know. And I think his creation really have like a place in there with Picasso and everyone else, you know. That's the way I see it. So the more people begin to see it in museums and things like that, a lot more people would start to see things the way that I see it.
For Studio 360, I'm Gigi Dubin.
Hard Truths, The Art of Thornton Dial is up at the Indianapolis Museum of Art through September. And you can see a slideshow of Dial's work right now at our website, studio360.org. While you're there, you can also check out dozens of other pieces of cool, below-the-radar artwork, all made by our listeners for the Studio 360 Material Mashup Challenge. Icicles, coffee grounds, toothpicks, all turned into DIY art. If you've made interesting things out of unusual materials, take a picture and post it at studio360.org. Coming up, the playwright David Lindsay Abaire says that talking to his working-class Boston family is like being bilingual.
Your father's out parking the car right now. Hold on, let me get him. Bugsy, get in here.
Your father's name Bugsy?
Yeah. Well, everybody in my family has a name that is their birth name, and then they have what everybody calls them. My mother was born Janet, but everybody calls her Sally. My Aunt Carol is Sissy. My Uncle Walter is called Butchie.
And you?
I'm Bud or Buddy. I'm also Davy, which is close enough to David. It actually makes sense.
That's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 is provided by PBS, celebrating 25 years of Les Mis and its classic songs like I Dreamed a Dream, Do You Hear the People Sing, and Master of the House, with the Les Miserables 25th Anniversary Concert, Sunday at 7, 6 Central on PBS. And by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. We all know somebody like Margie Walsh. She's the main character in the new play Good People, which is on Broadway right now. She is charming, irreverent. You love her. You sometimes are annoyed by her. She's also manipulative. When she falls on very hard times, she turns to an old friend who's become successful for help.
Why'd I lose my car? Because I missed a payment. Why did I miss a payment? Because I had to pay a dentist instead. Why did I have to pay a dentist? No, I have done this 100 times in my head, Mikey. I think you should hear it too. Why did I have to pay a dentist? Because I didn't have insurance and I cracked a tooth. And I ignored that for 6 months until an abscess formed. Why'd I crack a tooth?
I don't care.
Because one night I thought I'd save a little money and skip dinner, but I got hungry, so I snacked on a piece of candy brittle instead. And that is all it took. One piece of candy brittle, and I was out of a job again.
That's Frances McDormand as Margie Walsh in Good People by David Lindsay Abaire. He started out writing mostly absurdist comedies and the musical version of Shrek. But Good People is old-fashioned realism. It's set in the South Boston neighborhood where he grew up.
I think I did have to wait until I was mature enough, both as a person and as a writer, to tackle something that was so important to me. You know, these people I grew up with, and I love them desperately, and I want to be respectful to them, and I felt like I had to be old enough to do that.
As I was watching the play and enjoying it, I thought, my gosh, why for the last decade, dozen years, have we had this outpouring of good dramas about white working class characters from the same few Boston neighborhoods? I mean, Good Will Hunting, Mystic River, The Departed, The Town, Good People. What happened?
I have no idea. I think, I blame Ben Affleck mostly, right?
Yeah.
He's the one who keeps doing it. I don't know. You know, I do think that there is this romantic notion of these salt of the earth, hard working people that make good stories. They're great storytellers. They contain great stories within them.
And speaking of that, the specificity of the Boston accent, your actors who aren't from Boston, I think only one of them is, do a heroic job of imitating it. But none of them do it perfectly.
We're still in previews.
Okay.
You have to mention that. They're working on it.
What is it about the Boston accent that is so peculiar and uniquely hard for actors to imitate?
It's the vowels, I think. It's not just the R's.
Everything. I have it, yad, pack.
No, that's not it. It's the A's and the O's that are hard when you say cop instead of cop. So if I talk to my mother and she'll say, your father's out parking the car right now. Hold on, let me get him. Bugsy, get in here.
Your father's name Bugsy?
Yeah. Well, everybody in my family has a name that is their birth name, and then they have what everybody calls them. My mother was born Janet, but everybody calls her Sally. My Aunt Carol is Sissy. My Uncle Walter is called Butchie.
And you?
Well, I'm Bud or Buddy. I'm also Davy, which is close enough to David. It actually makes sense. But no, when I go to a private school, which is what I did in seventh grade, and you're 11 and nobody else is talking like you, even though it's the Boston area, they were out in the suburbs, so they didn't have Boston accents. They kicked it out of me pretty quickly.
The rain in Spain.
Exactly right.
Good People is about, as you suggest, being stuck at the sort of low end of the working class and about the struggle occasionally successful to escape. It's also, it seems to me, in a way more broadly about luck and about the crucial influence of bad luck, good luck in all of our life's fortunes. In the case of David Lindsay Abaire, what's the fraction in terms of their influence on your success?
Oh, I'd say luck is 90% of it. When I was 11 years old, I got a scholarship to a private school out in the suburbs, Milton Academy. And, you know, I was always a relatively smart kid, but there were a lot of smart kids that didn't get scholarships to private schools.
Right.
And not all of them ended up in prison, of course, but, you know, a lot of them didn't have the breaks and the opportunities that I had.
And so you got this special scholarship to Milton Academy, which is, I knew kids from Milton Academy in college. It's a very preppy prep school.
Yeah.
What did they think of you?
Well, first, I was mostly embraced. You know, I was the funny kid, so I was never picked on for being the poor kid. But I also didn't advertise where I came from, and I tried to, you know, get myself a pair of khakis and some Izod shirt so that I fit in. At the same time, I was never, of course, part of that world. You know, when vacations crept up, people would come back after a couple of weeks and most of the kids would be tanned and they had been to whatever tropical place they had been.
And you summered in Southie.
That's right. I watched television for a couple of weeks. And so there was that. But at the same time, of course, after a couple of years in Milton, I was no longer of the neighborhood really either because I was, you know, mingling with other people and getting a specific kind of education. And so I had a foot planted firmly in both of these worlds, but not really belonging entirely to either of them. And I think it sort of set me up to be a writer, frankly, to have that
inside, outside,
exactly.
Observe both worlds.
Exactly right.
And what did your friends in South Boston think of you once you became this preppy?
They were mostly embracing, actually. And I know a lot of people say, oh, they must have been so mad at you or so resentful. Honestly, they weren't. I was really embraced. And, you know, I would take some ribbing. Oh, here comes Mr. Prep. And, you know, even after I graduated from college, then I would come back and they would say, hey, Hollywood, how's it going? You know, sort of thing. But it was always good-natured, by and large.
And were people proud of you?
No question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Until 5 years ago, you were primarily known as a writer of farce and whimsical, absurdist stuff. Mm. Then you wrote Rabbit Hole, this old-fashioned kitchen sink realistic drama about a family dealing with the death of a child. It was on Broadway. It won the Pulitzer Prize. Suddenly, there was this new you, and now this play is another old-fashioned great piece of realistic theater. This seems to be, in terms of worldly acclaim, what the world wants from you. Do you want to keep giving it that mainly?
No. I think each play is going to decide for itself what it wants to be. I mean, Rabbit Hole was more of a conscious decision to move towards a more naturalistic play. I mean, you know, I had seen my name creeping up into other people's reviews, actually, to describe their absurdist comedies.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, oh, I see. People think that I write this kind of play. And it's sort of nice to
be. He's the new Chris Durang.
Exactly. But another thing that happened is I've been very lucky critically with those comedies, by and large. But the critics that hated the plays hated them with such an unbridled passion.
That's the problem with ambitious comedy, really.
Well, you know, when you do something bold, you know, it's an extreme expression.
Yeah.
And so some people don't like extremes. So I would then read reviews by these same critics who would approach a naturalistic play in a very different way. And the very cynical, angry part of me thought, I could write one of those damn plays if I wanted to.
Huh.
So I waited for a while. And then the rabbit hole idea came to me, and I thought, well, maybe this is the naturalistic play. Let me try it just this one time to see what happens. And rabbit hole came out the way that it did. And of course, yeah, Good People is, again, much more naturalistic. But I didn't feel an obligation to make it naturalistic because I thought, oh, people expect that from me now. More to the point, I think I was writing about people that I knew and wanted to write respectfully of them. And I felt like I didn't want to turn them into ridiculous people, someone that could be dismissed in the way that some of my earlier plays were dismissed by people
right.
as being just silly nonsense.
Well, one of the things you do in this play that I was struck by, Estelle Parsons plays an old, cranky, funny woman, which is a type of character that as soon as I see it in a movie or on stage, I think, oh, this is going to be horrible. This is going to be horrible. They're going to make fun of old people being wacky. And you didn't do that. And she performed your non-mortifying character beautifully.
Thank you. David Lindsay Baer writes non-mortifying characters.
Yes, there's you can put that on a marquee.
Thanks.
You wrote the film adaptation of Rabbit Hole, which is out now, starring Nicole Kidman. And you've written other films, but here's your own play turned into a film. The film gets made.
Yeah.
Did that process give you any revelations about big differences between the two mediums that you hadn't realized earlier?
No. I mean, the big revelation for me is that good things can happen when the writer has control. I'd written a couple other movies, but my name is on it, but there's literally hardly any of me in it. One of those movies, there's not a line of dialogue that's mine in it. And the other one
was...
What,
Robots?
Robots. There's not a line of dialogue
really?
That I wrote in it. But
Inkheart?
Inkheart was so... I mean, it's a fine movie, but it's not a movie by David Lindsay Baer, even though my name is on it. When I was approached by Nicole Kidman about Rabbit Hole, I said, look, I only want to do it if you want to tell the same story that I want to tell. I have the play. I don't need to make a bad movie version of it. If I want to make a little money, I can go do that wrecking somebody else's story. I don't need to do it myself. And she stayed true to her word. She said, you're going to be part of this process. We want you to be proud of the script. You're going to be involved with picking the actors and the director. And it's true. They kept me involved that whole process and hired people that understood the material implicitly and told the same story, which never, ever happens.
Well, once again, congratulations on a terrific play.
Thank you very much.
David Lindsay Baer, thank you for coming into Studio 360. And Good People is on Broadway now with, no doubt, perfect Boston accents by the time you see it.
No doubt.
Where are the good people go?
And at Studio360.org, on our blog, you can hear David Lindsay Baer talk about his next project, which I can't wait for. A movie prequel to The Wizard of Oz, directed by Sam Raimi. Alabama, South Boston, and next on our transcontinental road trip this week, Eastern Washington State.
In this highway.
50 years ago, when he was not quite 60, John Steinbeck turned a road trip into his last major book, Travels with Charlie in Search of America. Steinbeck packed up a camper truck with his dog Charlie and spent 3 months traveling all over the United States. Over the last few weeks, we've been revisiting some of Steinbeck's stops, including Sag Harbor, New York, and New Orleans. Today, we're in Spokane, Washington, on the western edge of the Rocky Mountains. In Travels with Charlie, Steinbeck stops at a seedy diner just outside Spokane, where he meets a big, gruff guy and the man's son, Robbie. When we went to Spokane, our guide was Troy Nickerson, and we met up with him at the Civic Theater. It turns out Troy has a lot in common with Steinbeck's Robbie.
This is the main stage. What is this seat, David? 300 and... something like that, 350-something. This is David Baker. He's one of the scenic designers at the theater. Civic's been around, I think, 60 years. Is that right, about 60 years?
Good. How are you all feeling? A little bit of za, 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 za.
I'm Troy Nickerson. I was born in 1965, born and raised in Spokane. I'm a hairdresser and a director of community theater, some professional theater, and a choreographer. This is the set for Annie Get Your Gun.
Just go from the big stuff. Just when I start singing, there's no.
Yeah. All right, let's start at the chair.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Are you ready? One, two.
There's no business like show business. There's no business like show business. There's no business like show business. Like no business I know. There's no business like show business. Like no.
I grew up in this theater. My first show, I believe, I was 13. My brother was always kind of a sports dude, and I was just kind of drawn to it, and did tons of shows, and then they asked me to direct Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, I think basically because nobody else wanted to, and I did it, and it turned out really well, and I've been kind of directing almost every year since then. So in Steinbeck's travels, he comes to a small area outside of Spokane and finds a little place to stay, where he meets a flamboyant young man named Robbie and his father. There was a knock on the door, and I admitted a young man of about 20.
Dressed in gray flannel slacks, two-tone shoes, a polka-dotted ascot, and a blazer with the badge of a Spokane high school.
His dark, shining hair
was a masterpiece of overcombing. The top hair laid back and crisscrossed with long side strands that just cleared the ears.
So then the young man meets Steinbeck and is struck by the fact that he's from New York City and wants to know more about New York City because he's so entranced about theater. And he says, well, you know, there's no theater and no music and no one to talk to.
The burly proprietor's face was red as a raspberry when I went into the lunch counter.
Here Steinbeck meets the father of the young man.
He thrust his jaw at me. As if I ain't having enough trouble, you got to be from New York. Is that bad? For me it is. I just got that kid quieted down and you put burrs under his blanket.
The father talks about how ambitious Robbie is. And that he took a course. And the course, he says, it's not barbering. Hairdressing for women.
Now maybe you see why I got worries. Robbie turned from carving the ham. The slender knife was held rigidly in his right hand. He searched my face for the look of contempt he expected. I went through my beans and half my ham before I answered him. It is my considered opinion that the hairdresser is the most influential man in any community.
Steinbeck is trying to calm the father down, talking about how hairdressers have this ability with women because they share their confidence and they put their confidence and trust in them and tell them things that they don't tell anybody else. And he says to him, I'm not smiling when I say it.
I tell you that a clever, thoughtful, ambitious hairdresser wields a power beyond the comprehension of most men. Jesus Christ, you hear that, Robbie? Did you know all that?
The dad actually kind of responds to the fact that somebody has some respect for his son and somebody that actually doesn't find him embarrassing or just because he's gay, but finds something with integrity about what his son does. And I think it makes the dad feel good about his son for a moment. You know, it's hard for me to imagine what it would like to be Robbie in 1960. I mean, my own journey in the 80s was terrifying, so I'm sure how alone he must have felt, how scared and how badly he just wanted to go away and get out of here and find people like him, you know, just to find his community.
10 and 1 is fine.
I can't give you the extra one.
My dad's and my relationship has evolved so much that it's kind of crazy.
My name is Francis L. Nickerson. Everybody calls me Nick.
All right. See you later, Nick. Thanks.
Yes, sir. He's a barber. You know, he's 81 and works 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. Towards high school when I was, you know, kind of going out and doing things, and I think it became clear that I was gay and that I was, you know, seeing some boys and hanging out, and I think it really kind of had a wedge in between us.
And when I heard about it, I was a little bit devastated. I told him, I said, look, It's either one way or the other, and I prefer to go this way.
When I finally kind of came out and he found out, I actually took off and moved to Seattle, where I started beauty school, and I lived there for probably 6-7 months, and we really didn't talk until I think it was like a week before Christmas, and I called home, and I talked to my dad, and my brother was there, and he was just talking to me how much he missed me, and I was crying and telling him I missed him too, and my brother actually got in the car and drove to Seattle in a snowstorm, picked me up and drove me back home, and, you know, hugged, and, you know, and I've been here ever since. But it was still after that, it was still different, it was still unique. He didn't get it for a long, long, long time.
To me, in my era, see, that was a kind of a funny thing, you know. Well, I did a little studying, and I met some of these people, and some of the people in the theater, it's unbelievable how many of them people are same way, you know. And so I thought, well, it's either this or I'll lose him. I'm not going to lose him. No way. Okay.
Have a good day.
You bet.
My father is, you know, so amazingly proud of me and kind and wonderful in these past years. It's hard to even kind of remember the man that he used to be. It's just so different. It's cool.
Would you like a program?
Thank you.
There you go. Enjoy the show.
Good evening. So I'm here to let you know what we're doing next year. We're opening the season with the Buddy Holly story, bringing back some of your favorite actresses in Nonsense. A White Christmas. Fun, kind of crazy farce, a lot like Noises Off, called Don't Dress for Dinner. And then I'll be directing to close the season, The Full Monty. So, yeah. Thank you for your support, and have a good night.
The theater director and hairdresser Troy Nickerson in Spokane, Washington. Our series retracing John Steinbeck's travels with Charlie comes to us from John Biewen of the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. Next week, we visit Steinbeck's home territory, the town he really made famous, Monterey, California. The budget deficits faced by governments all over the country means that arts funding is on the chopping block everywhere. A couple of weeks ago, we looked at Kansas, where the governor has eliminated the State Arts Commission. I talked to Roger Reitz, who's a Republican state senator who wants to restore that funding.
St. Paul said, you know, hold fast to that which is good. I've never forgot that phrase in the Bible. That's in Romans. And when you think of it that way, then you've got something good. Don't throw it away. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Kansas is better than that.
What cultural institution or maybe even individual artist is threatened by funding cuts where you live? And what do you think should be done about it, if anything? We want to know. You can call and leave us a voicemail at 646-580-0360. Tell us where you live and what your name is. Or you can weigh in online at studio360.org. Over the next few weeks, we're going to be keeping an eye on this process and debate across the country. And we may even take a closer look at your hometown, but only if you tell us about it. Again, you can leave us a message at 646-580-0360, or write us about it at studio360.org. Coming up...
Are you a zombie, a spaceship, or a wasteland?
The comedian and actor Patton Oswalt explains the universe.
Anything we create has to involve simplifying, leaving, or destroying the world we're living in.
That's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. You might know the comedian Patton Oswalt from character roles on TV shows like Bored to Death or The United States of Tara. Or, as I discovered him, doing the voice of Remy, the star rat in the fabulous Pixar movie Ratatouille.
I can't help myself. I like good food, okay? And good food is hard for a rat to find.
But now he's moved on from Epicurean rodents to flesh-eating zombies and spaceships and wastelands.
Darth Vader is essentially a zombie born in a wasteland who works on a spaceship.
In his new book of essays called Zombie, Spaceship, Wasteland, Oswald explains how each one of us conforms to one of these sci-fi fantasy archetypes.
Are you a zombie, a spaceship, or a wasteland? For my group of friends, after seeing Star Wars in 1977, around age 8, and then Night of the Living Dead and all the 80s slasher films, and The Road Warrior in 1981, the answer to that question decided our destinies. Each of these categories represents different aspects of a shared teen experience. The early outcasts, like me, were late to sex and careers. If we did find a vocation, it usually involved drawing or writing or something creative, work that's done in the home and usually alone. The real-world experience we're going to need as writers or artists or filmmakers will come later, when we actually have to get a real job to support whatever creative thing we're hoping to do. So until then, anything we create has to involve simplifying, leaving, or destroying the world we're living in. Zombies simplify. Every zombie story is fundamentally about a breakdown of order with the infrastructure intact. The infrastructure might be on fire, yes, and it's great fun to crash a bus through a department store window as the driver finds himself torn to shreds by the suddenly zombified passengers. But the world, appearance-wise, survives. A friend of mine from high school, more of a passing acquaintance now that I think of it, was a hardcore zombie before he even knew it. He had an unshakable love for the awkward and outcast and a quiet, final disgust with the slick and false. Years later, when I'd moved to L.A., he sent me a zombie script he'd written. Not a bad effort, not a great one. At one point in the script, one of the characters knocks a zombie off a boat. I asked him innocently, "It never occurred to me, would a zombie care if it were underwater or not? They don't breathe. Would they even know?" This was his terse answer. "For your information, zombies can live underwater. They just don't like it." He was a zombie who'd long ago taken a zombie-eyed view of the world. You see them everywhere, rolling their eyes outside a rock club at how lame the band was, shaking their heads over a newspaper in a coffee shop. Resentful, under office lighting. Zombies can't believe the energy we waste on non-food pursuits. Spaceships leave. No surviving infrastructure for them. No Earth, period. That would still involve people. Every spaceship kid I knew growing up now works in computers. They got there through new wave, post-punk video games, and science fiction. Why bother reading subtle facial cues and emotional signals when there's a vast yet finite map of a motherboard to tinker with? The opening shot of Star Wars with the sleek Rebel ship and then the massive Imperial Star Destroyer barreling across the screen like the pan across a party in an Altman film permanently doomed a generation of spaceships to their insular, slightly muted lives. Laser cannons take the place of conversation. Deflector shields are emotional nuance.
Deflectors on. Red alert.
In their bodies, skulls, and spirits, a chunk of my peers became spaceships, skimming over the surface of the world, maneuvering their own lives. Deflector shields up. Spaceships are the ones most likely to get married and have kids. They treat their houses like spaceships that have landed on Earth and their spouses and kids like crew members, which makes them pretty good parents. They've always got emergency kits, lists of most used numbers, backup supplies of ointment, painkillers, and bottled water.
The vision dims this wasted land.
Wastelands destroy. They're confused but fascinated by the world, so the idea of zooming off in a self-contained spaceship, no matter how lovingly described or sensually evoked, as I said, smacks of retreat. The solution? Wasteland. Post-nuke, post-meteor striker, simply a million years into the future, that's the perfect environment for the Wasteland's imagination to gallop through. Wastelands are almost always swallowed up by punk rock and science fiction. They're also the most likely to keep journals and usually the first to get menial jobs.
Welcome to Walmart!
Weirdly, Wastelands are the most hopeful and sentimental of the bunch, because even though they've destroyed the world as we know it, they conceive of stories in which a core of humanity, either in actual numbers of survivors or in the conscience of a lone hero, survives and endures. Wastelands and college love Beckett.
We no rights anymore?
Oh, you'd make me laugh if it wasn't prohibited.
We've lost our rights.
We got rid of them.
Looking back on it now, I realize I'm a wasteland. A lot of comedians are wastelands. What is stand-up comedy except isolating specific parts of culture or humanity and holding them up against a stark, vast background to approach at an oblique angle and get laughs? Or in a broader sense, pointing out how so much of what we perceive as culture and society is disposable waste. Plus, comedians have to work the road. We wander the country, seeking outposts full of cheap booze, nachos, and audiences in order to ply our trade. I'm amazed we all don't wear sawed-off shotguns on our hips. In reality, I got sick of doing jokes in front of the zombies at the local comedy clubs. I moved to San Francisco, in a used Jetta, not a spaceship. And driving cross-country wasn't wandering the wasteland, but Utah came close enough.
Patton Oswalt reading from the title essay of his new book, Zombie Spaceship Wasteland. So, what are you? Zombie, spaceship, or wasteland? Me, I think I'm a wastelandy spaceship. But we've got a diagnostic quiz that you can take at studio360.org. And if there's anybody who's figured out how to capitalize on being different, it's Lady Gaga, who is totally a zombie-ish wasteland, by the way. If you've looked at a computer screen or TV or a magazine in the last year, you know Gaga's performance art wardrobe. The skimpy suit made out of raw meat, the coat made out of Kermit the Frog heads, etc. Studio 360's resident troubadour Scott Blazek just wanted a date with Lady Gaga. But it got complicated.
Well, I was out in the village one day and a pretty little blonde crossed my way. I noticed something up with her clothes. I tipped my hat, she thumbed her nose. Said, what's your name? And she said, they call me Gaga. Got up my nerve, took her for a drink. Girl shows up looking like a circus freak. A cocktail dress of sawdust and grease. They threw her out for disrupting the peace. A strange gal. Still, I kinda liked her though. Well, fluke, I figured, trying to make sense. But on day two, she wore an electric fence. Just, what's your deal? I said with a stare. She said, oh, I don't explain what I wear. That night I made it to second base. Got third degree burns. Now I've been with all kind of gal, from Dakota Badlands to the Appalachian Trail. I ain't picky, but it's hard to swallow when your date looks like the Guggenheim Bilbao. Over the next month, she wore a full body cast. Steering unit of a Buick, vinyl siding, jacket made of some kind of fish, satellite dish, rice dish, hat made out of false teeth, fake fur made out of real teeth, and a sundress I've made out of things that I can't mention on the radio. That should have been a red flag right there. Oh, wedding bells and phony smiles. Next thing I know, I'm at the end of an aisle. The organ moan, the crowd aghast at my bride-to-be wearing the corpse of Johnny Cash. I took off running. I got chased. Till Johnny's head got caught in the gazebo. So I settled down with Susie Clare. When she wants attention, she puts a bow in her hair. Oh, Gaga, I hope you're not too sore. It wasn't used, all that stuff you wore. I miss you, I do. I'd like to give it another go, but you dress like there's something wrong in your head, and it just creeps me out.
You can hear all of Scott Blazek's Talking Blues tunes at Studio360.org. But just for the record, personally, I kind of love Lady Gaga, especially the costumes. And that is it for today's show. Don't forget that between shows and podcasts, you can follow us at Studio360.org and on Facebook and Twitter. If you're craving us in more tangible form, Studio 360 now has a brand new book. It's called Spark, How Creativity Works, and it's filled with lessons from artists we've had on the show about how they manage their creativity. Find out more at studio360.org/spark. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Mulad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore, Michael
Guerriero, Sarah D'Elia,
Mary Dew. And thanks, as ever, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, sex, lies, and a curtain call. Filmmaker Steven Soderbergh says goodbye to Hollywood.
When you reach the point where you're like, if I have to get into another van to do another scout, I'm just going to shoot myself. It's time to let somebody else who's still excited about getting in the van, get in the van.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.